Welcome. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Tonight, we have another show dealing with, of course, science, metaphysics, the two kind of joining together at various points, physics itself, as well as spirituality, and I would say certainly tonight we're going to be dealing with issues about the soul, because in my dealings with people on a fairly regular basis, most people have no idea really what the difference is between a soul and us, being a part of the soul, we could say that, and part of the soul is part of other beings as well, but different kinds of souls, different kinds of life. And so this needs to be fairly clarified. I wanted to also talk about it from the soul's perspective, because I've never had a show that actually explains it from the soul's perspective, rather, because we are usually so, generally self-focused as a being, human beings are. Most people want to hear it from our perspective. But from the soul's perspective, the soul's prerogatives are mostly somewhat different from what the choices are that humans make, and sometimes have to actually preempt humans. And the same is true, of course, of animals and plants. And so it's not necessarily, today's show is not necessarily like any other soul that I've done, show I've done on the soul, because of that issue. So this is going to be definitely different. Also, Don, the owner manager of the station, has graciously allowed us to go longer until further notice, and we really appreciate that, so that we'll be able to go a bit over the normal two-hour time frame. Now, you might say, well, I've had enough of this guy after 2 hours. But, you know, I'm trying to give your brains a rest here and there so that we won't tax the apparatus, but the mind never really gets tired. The brains do sometimes, and so we'll try to make it we'll say user friendly. And that being the case, and without much ado, I want to bring up some other elements that, since I have the extra time today, to kind of clarify some things that people have talked to me about on occasion. And a lot of these people haven't necessarily read the textbook I wrote, you know, Life's Hidden Meaning, or one of the many, many articles or lectures I've given. So they don't know the necessary perspective I have, and they want to know my perspective because they want to be able to compare that to their own and to other people that they've heard. So I'm going to go over some of these things. Now, my perspective, I believe, is the soul's perspective. But again, anything I say about any subject is still filled with various ideas and opinions and thoughts I have. So we can never dissociate the thinker from that which the thinker says. And I always preface anything I say based upon that idea. So that being the case, and since we do have more time, I thought I'd bring this up right now to kind of clarify more about some of the things I'm going to talk about the rest of the show. And it's particularly relevant because, like last night, if you saw the vice presidential debate, the interesting point was at the end of the debate, there was a question posed, well, what are your thoughts about abortion? And each of the two candidates gave their own thinking about it. Most of you know that I prefer the Republican candidates to the Democratic, but that's not to leave out the Libertarian candidates or anybody in the Green Party or this or that. It's only to say that the likely ones to be elected, the better choice, in my opinion, by far, is the Republican, only because, particularly President Obama, I consider to be heavily, heavily tainted by narcissism and leanings, very strong leanings towards a thing called, we'll call it this, but there's many other names for it, anti-colonial communism, or some people call it colonial communism. I don't know why you could reverse those and still being the same thing, but some people say it means the same thing. And what that means is that his father and he, and to some extent his mother and his grandparents, believe that the United States is interfering with and preventing people to be free to pursue a, we'll call it a plan of social justice and of the ability to live their lives in a way which is contrary to some of the elements of American society, which includes the right for people to independently and individually choose their own destiny. So this being the case, from that perspective, from the perspective of a candidate who is also presently president of the United States, seeking a un-American and, in some respects, anti-American position, which I hold to be closer to the truth about God and ageless wisdom and the founders' ideas, of course, he would not be the candidate that I would choose. Nonetheless, on some of the things I'm going to be talking about, they don't necessarily match up with the Republicans' position, and they might, in some cases, better match up with the Democratic position. So this is not a question now of Republican versus Democratic or Libertarian or any other position that other parties might have. It's really about the perspective of the soul and what choices the soul, or we can say prerogatives of choices, because the prerogative means it's the ability to not only have the choice but to exercise it, just so we understand what that word means. So to begin tonight's show, I think it would be interesting to start with this. And normally I start purely with just the intellectual conceptual side. This is a practical issue. But heck, what the heck, we can jumble things around, and that might give your brain an easier time when we come to the end of the second hour and I say, hey, we're going to go a little further, you know, if you have the time. So here's the point. There are a number of issues that I don't think necessarily fall into the ideological lines of a specific party. It's really about soul versus human or personality or personal choices. The human is guided more by the personality on an average than by the soul. We should recognize that. For most people, this is a true statement. And I say most being like way over the 98th percentile range. So it's a big deal in terms of the amount that people are affected by their personal side. And one of those personal sides deals with the question of abortion. Some people, the majority apparently in this country, in the United States, think that the right to life is the appropriate choice, which apparently has been shifted into, for maybe the majority of people, the right to demand that other people not be allowed to have abortions by some legal fiat or legal laws or judgments by some legal body. It could be the legislature, the Supreme Court, or the executive branch with today's typical way of handling things from the executive branch is to just create executive orders as a dictatorship. But whatever method is used, this has been my position, as stated in several different articles I've written and also in Life's Hidden Meaning, which is a textbook. I simply said that the government should be out of it. There is no justification, in my opinion, for the government to decide this particular issue. It shouldn't be a question of law, because it's a question of, we'll say, a person's relationship to their soul and to God. It's a First Amendment right, in reality, which is already covered in the Constitution, because it is a religious issue, on whether or not a person can or can't choose to have an abortion. Now, why do I say that? Because most people who are in the Right to Life group state that the fetus has a right to life. And here is where I think it's fairly understandable that they believe that therefore they have a right to protect the rights of the fetus against the rights of the mother. The problem is the fetus is dependent upon and living within the mother to such an extent that until a certain formidable point in time, that relationship is 100%, meaning that the mother is the one that has to 100% give to the fetus, and it can't live separated from the fetus. In cases like with child abuse, we could say, well, we'll just take the child away from the mother, and that solves the problem, right? It's not such a big deal, although certainly it's a traumatic issue to both sides and everyone else, but it can be done. But you can't take a living fetus outside of the mother before a certain point in time. And that is the bottom line of the problem, is that the mother then becomes a, we'll say, a slave to the system and laws if you decide that the fetus has superior rights to the mother. And superior would be its right to life is greater than that of the mother's. Kind of a strange idea, isn't it? It's one that, in particular, we can resolve. It is resolvable, but only from the soul's perspective. And this is where it gets difficult. As I explained in the textbook, this can be resolved by two issues. Now, one of them is science, and what we know scientifically, and the other is somewhat philosophical. But let's deal with this from, and this will kind of lead us into what souls are really about. Let's deal with this from the scientific side. This is a moving target, because the ability for a fetus to live outside of a mother is changeable. I mean, today it's like the 23rd week, give or take. You go back 50 years ago, it was the 27th week. So you see, things aren't changing. And that means that the law would have to be, if there was a law written about this, have to be a timely law that changes based upon some given amount of proof in science. And you can see why a law about that would be crazy. Well, today's law is going to be different than tomorrow's law. And then what area of the country and where, what kind of facilities do they have? And you can go on and on. Or the world, for that matter. I mean, you can see that this is a very difficult subject to legislate in any respect based upon science. So that's why that's the first strike against the law. You can see, well, that science doesn't give us anything other than a moving target that slightly may move lower, but at some point may not move lower, may move higher because you miscalculated and you can't go that low. You know, I mean, you can get into all kinds of issues where 95% of the time the fetus dies no matter what. And that's is that good? Okay. So, and can you demand that someone do that? And maybe 95% of the fetus dies and 7% of the time the mother dies. Now what kind of outcomes do you have? You can see the problem of science here. Okay, then we can look at it from the soul's perspective. From the soul's perspective, again, this is my opinion based upon a lot of experiences that I consider to be factual, but you don't have to buy it. As far as the soul is concerned, the consciousness of the human being does not reach the physical level. In other words, there is no recognition of individual self, none, in a fetus if it were born before about, give or take, 18 weeks. So that's my, this is a whole other thing, and it can range anywhere from 16, 18, because consciousness is not perfect from one soul in its incarnate to another. It changes based upon the level of advancement of the soul and the incarnate. Oh, how hard that gets into. Now, so here again is another, it's not a moving target as much as, well, it is a moving target, but it isn't a moving target in any one direction. It's all over the place. You could have some less conscious people and their souls, maybe not being self-conscious until 20 weeks. And you may have some that are self-conscious at 16 and a half or 17 weeks. You see the issue here, I hope. That being true, if you believe it's true, okay, then how do you legislate about that? Okay, let's flip a coin, or can we give a consciousness test to a fetus? I mean, where do we understand the nature of a human at the level of consciousness while it's in the womb of an adult woman, or at least a woman who is doing an adult role, which is having a child, but she may not be, by our standards, an adult. How is it that we then make this decision, both of these, science and, we'll call it, spiritual, metaphysical realities, do not add up to a legal definition that we could enforce in any reasonable way? I hope you're hearing me. Now, I realize this doesn't fit the Republican position. You know, life begins at inception. Well, life does, but human life doesn't. That's not a human life. Could it become a human life? Well, if it makes it to 17 weeks, 18 weeks, and 20 weeks, yeah, it could become. But then again, does that mean that every sperm and egg is a human life? Well, some people believe that. I mean, by the time you're done in this situation, you know, maybe red blood cells are human life. I mean, before long, you get to a point where you don't any longer have the ability to say anything other than I feel. It's not a thought process anymore. It becomes a sentimental feeling aspect. Sentimental means that your sentiment, senti, the senses you're using are astral, controlling the mental. Well, it's also called common renarsic, and we know we can't rely upon it. But some people do. Okay. And many religions do. So this is a point that we need to be particularly concerned about. Religions are sentimental by definition, if not any other way. They certainly are. And so we have this issue, and the soul has it down, and the soul understands it. From its perspective, it's okay where it is at. But from the perspective of human beings, we just don't have the ability to legally define and control this particular part of the rights of all people at one time. Say, this is going to be the way it is. So how do we protect this? Well, this is difficult. My perspective was, well, why don't we just make it like, you know, 18 to 20 weeks, you can have abortions as you need to. After that, you have to have some extreme examples where the threat to one being is greater by far than the threat to the other. It gets into a complicated formula that I wouldn't want to even venture into, because there's too many arguments to the other side anyway. The best thing is no law about it. And there we get into the right to choose. Therefore, this is not a societally decided issue. This is an issue decided entirely by the individual in their own rights, and it probably involves not just the mother, it might involve the father, but that's a whole other story. Now we get into two sides there. And some states recognize this, some don't. So you get into those kinds of questions, but nonetheless, we should leave people to make this decision themselves under the First Amendment and consider this a religious freedom. That, or in this case, spiritual freedom, because I consider that the real point of, if we're going to define it. But regardless, we'll call it religious, spiritual, however you want to define that. And this is such a big subject, I know I'm going to get some emails about this. How could you say that after you say you want to get rid of the crazy Democrats? Because I don't want to get rid of Democrats. I just want to get rid of a guy who is a narcissist and wants to do evil things to the world. That's all. Through his power in the United States. I don't want to get rid of Democrats. I think they got some interesting ideas and thoughts, and some of the stuff they say is very important. All right. So there's the first side of the soul. I'll give you one more. There's a whole bunch of these, by the way, about 100 maybe. But I'm just going to go over a couple so that we could start seeing how different we think compared to the soul. And the soul's perspective on things is going to not necessarily match what we as people at our present level of consciousness think. All right. Boy, am I glad I got extra time, because I just spent a whole lot of time on that thing. But that wasn't that hard, right? You found that to be an interesting thought, right? I hope. Okay. So I'm not burning up your brain yet, right? All right. Yeah, I know. I stuck a few concepts in there. It's still pretty big. Okay, I got it. All right, so let's talk about another one of these, oh boy, topics. And that is the rights of people who are quote-unquote gay, homosexual, however you want to define yourself or themselves, is in comparison to those of people who are heterosexual. Well, I was very clear, I thought, when I wrote this, that not only should the government support the rights of homosexuals in exactly the same way as those of heterosexuals, but they should support the right for homosexuals to demand their rights as being citizens or whatever they are, living here and foreigners or whatever, regardless of whether they're homosexual or not. I even said that they should, as a matter of helping themselves to develop more consciousness, because there's a personality issue involved in being homosexual for about 99% of homosexuals. It's not just, well, I was born that way, so I'm going to stay that way. And it's, no, there's all kinds of issues involved in it. But the point is that regardless of that fact, they actually could get better by demanding and fighting for their own rights as humans. Heck, long before they're heterosexual, they're a human being, right? Yeah, and they have the same rights. And so if they want to get married, let them get married. If they want to get a driver's license, let them get a driver's license. If they want to be able to teach in a school system, they should be able to teach in a school system. And anything else that the rest of us that may not be homosexual want to do, it's the same thing for them. So this is the point that I'm trying to get at. Now, I know people have all kinds of, you know, we'll say biases, prejudices against homosexual people. This is to say that because someone's homosexual, there is no reason the government should be enacting laws against them, period. I don't care what it is. Now you say, well, what about the military? Oh, the military. Shouldn't they have separate but equal housing because they're going to get involved in, you know, making other people uncomfortable if they express their sexuality, express it, you know, while in a closed environment, in intimate circumstances, because they're both naked or so, with heterosexuals. And here's where I think the military has a right to draw a line, so to speak. They try to do this, but don't ask, don't tell, and they kind of, that's like halfway right, but it isn't right. and I'll explain what's wrong with it. It's halfway right because they tried with Don't Ask, Don't Tell to prevent the homosexual person from expressing themselves in their homosexuality while another person couldn't get away. They have to live with, be naked with, shower with, who knows will do what with, this person because of the their civil rights are removed. They are under military rights, which don't give them the right to just walk out and say, I'm going to go live someplace else. They can't. So in giving up their civil rights, they put themselves in this vulnerable position. And some people have said, that's not fair. Well, it may not be, but that's a whole other issue. Fairness is not really what we're dealing with here. There's some other factors. Okay, so how do you resolve this? Because and the military tried to resolve it by saying, well, if the homosexual person doesn't say anything about their homosexuality, then that's all cool. Don't ask, don't tell. But the problem with this is more about the responsibility of each individual in their expression of their homosexuality rather than don't ask, don't tell. The whole thing is just dumb in that respect because, oh, I'll be a homosexual and I won't say I'm a homosexual, but I'll go around blowing kisses at all my same-sex fellow combatants with me. And, you know, that won't do anything wrong, right? Well, that'd be a lot worse than just telling me you're homosexual, believe me. So you can see there's a problem in the expression point, and that's what they couldn't deal with because they didn't know how to quantify it or to define it. And so my suggestion is, you make it an individual responsibility based upon the needs of the group, which is what the military says military law is about. Ah! Now we're within the law. They probably can get away with this. They can get away with it, in my opinion. Don't Ask, Don't Tell doesn't deal with the issue. And it may, in fact, not allow a person who is homosexual to be enough of a person in that circumstance. I think it's perfectly okay for people to say, hey, I'm a homosexual, because the other people around them should be able, as an adult, and going into the military, recognize this is going to be part of the military life. That's the other part of it. So it's like when you sign up to tell you this, you may be around people who tell you they're going to be homosexual. You don't like it, don't join the military. But at the same time, you tell the people who are going to be homosexual, your responsibility is not to make the other people feel uncomfortable by blowing kisses at them, making sexual innuendos, or doing anything that in some way allows your sexuality to intervene with the sexuality of heterosexuals that are around you. And therefore, you cannot exercise sexuality at all towards those that are of the same sex, period. Whether you admit you're a homosexual or not, you can't do it. You have the right to admit you're a homosexual, so you can ask and be told, or told and tell, or you can choose not to. It's up to you. But this behavior is not tolerated because people are confined to a combat situation or non-combat, but at least they're getting ready for combat, and they can't live any other way. They have to live together because these connections that you get when you live together help you to defend the country because you're defending each other. The personal side is attached to the group purpose side. They want people to find personal relationships with each other, so in the battlefield they will support each other more by that personal relationship as well as their desire to defend the country. The guy next to you becomes your buddy, even your salvation and the holding grace and everything else. So you're going to defend that person, and they'll defend you on a personal level while you both are defending the country. This is the psychology of military life. It's very important. And to disturb it will destroy the military. The way to protect it and still have homosexual people in the military is to do what I just said. And you can say, well, they'll have witch hunts. There'll be people out They're saying, well, that guy wiggled his ass at me, and or that woman smiled at me in some sexual way. You know, yeah, that could happen. That could happen. And it certainly, that's one of the complexities of this kind of situation. It's based upon individual expression. But you would have to have witnesses, I would think. You can require this, that there has to be more than one person saying this about the other person, and then maybe they give them lie detector tests, honestly, or some other means of determining whether this is going on. Maybe the other person is doing it subconsciously, though. And if they are, they can correct it. You give them a chance, a warning. Please, don't do this again. I mean, it isn't a fatal flaw if someone does it one or two times. The question is, how much does it disturb totally? If it's done every day, yeah, it's going to kind of freak people out, right? Okay. So you stop it. And I think, you know, you get so many warnings, and you do go through a process if necessary before someone is just booted out. All right. So I think that this is the better alternative for the question of that part of homosexual life. And that, again, is not about civil rights, because you lose your civil rights when you go into the military. This is an aside from that. But as far as the normal civil rights of people are concerned, should they be allowed to get married? Sure. But I told you this in a prior broadcast. I said, hey, listen, as far as I'm concerned, everybody that chooses to get married is not doing a religious thing. It's only a governmental contract. That's what I would make. I would make marriage into a government. Everybody that says they're married, it's a governmental contract. So anything that is dealing with the government, you call it marriage, and that's it. But you have another name, which you call spiritual marriage, that people say that they've done, and they recognize it with a specific kind of spiritual. And under spiritual marriage, now you could change the words around. I don't care what words you use here. So one could be called marriage, the other can be called spiritual connections, I don't know. But that kind of spiritual will be connected to either a religious or spiritual viewpoint, and if that religion and or spiritual viewpoint is what you're talking about, is supporting homosexuality, fine, no problem. If it doesn't, then you're just telling people something that isn't true because you're a member of a particular spiritual group or order that says, no, we don't recognize homosexuals. Fine, that's the way it is. But the government can say you're married only from the standpoint that it is not a spiritual union, but it's a contract that gives you certain issues, certain rights, and everybody has a right to enter into that contract, regardless of whether they're homosexual or heterosexual. But spiritual marriage is based upon where and who is giving you that spiritual decree, and that would be a separate issue. Now you would have two things. If you want to hang them on the wall, one is a thing from the government that says you're entitled to certain benefits and responsibilities if you choose to get governmentally married. And then the other one is spiritual, and it's what your belief in God is about, and that's a totally different thing, and that's only given to some people in certain religions who are heterosexual and other religions who are homosexual or vice versa and whatever. That's it. That solves that problem. And so you change the words marriage is between a man and a woman to governmentally recognized or whatever. Marriage is between any two people who wish it to be so. And then those rights that the government gives to people for such marriage is bestowed upon them. Now, maybe the government doesn't give some rights that they give today. In an act situation, maybe you would say, well, no, there's certain rights the government no longer is going to give you. But you have to be careful, because if you're not going to give people who are homosexual those rights, you can't give it to people who are heterosexual. You can't separate these two ideas from each other because they are one. Are you following me? Now, why is this so important? Because the rights of a human being supersede the personal and sometimes maddening personal choices that humans make. Whether they're good, bad, or indifferent, they have the right to make them. And if they're against the rights of a soul, that's a whole other thing. But if they're against the rights of a law, for some, not applied to others, it's civilly unconstitutional and wrong. So we have ways to defund these things. Now, do I think in the present climate it's okay that some states have decided that marriage is between a man and a woman, and the Congress so supposedly said that? Probably the way, the broad stroke with that is probably not right. Probably not right. Because it isn't well enough defined, and this is where the problem lies. So in other words, what I'm saying is the definition is wrong, because people then are going to be discriminated against because they either are or are not married, but homosexual. And that's not a fair thing. It's not a good deal. So we have to have the same laws applying. And that's where our problem is. Now, some states have gone one way with this, another way. There's other problems. There's no question. Having children, did the rights of the children then get involved? Well, some states may decide you can get married, you can do anything you want, but if you want to adopt children, then we got a problem with that, because homosexuality introduces an aberrant lifestyle to children. And as a group, we have the right to decide what's best for children if it harms them. So the question is, does it harm children? You know, you get into all these other factors. And that's where you get to individuality. Maybe some parents can work this out so it doesn't harm their kids. If they teach their kids, well, you know, if you want to be heterosexual, that's a cool thing, and it's probably a more normal, natural position for people to have, because most people are heterosexual. So you might want to consider that. There's all kinds of factors that can be involved in that particular situation. That's probably the worst one right there. That's where the crux of the problem might come. Interestingly, in most states where the argument has been posed, that has not been the issue. But I think it should be, and that it can be worked out. It can be designed so that it is neutral. It's hard to. I wrote that's one of the hardest things to resolve, and I didn't have an easy answer. I can't give a single statement that will resolve it for all people, because it's more about individual bringing up of kids. It's not about, you know, oh, here's the law, and you just do this, and everything's going to work out. It's not. And so, unfortunately, I wish there was something that you could say about it that would be simple enough, but there isn't. So that's where we get into that kind of thought process. All right. At any rate, I hope that this has brought you to where we're going to start the show, because I just blew our first 40 minutes, which is what I usually start the show. So what I'm telling you is we may go about 40 minutes longer or something like that. But again, the things that I'm talking about aren't going to be as conceptually difficult as when we come back. I'll do my normal thing where we'll talk about what a soul is, and we get into the harder parts of this whole thing. I hope this has actually brought you to a place where you could start seeing that a soul's perspective is going to be considerably different in some circumstances than a human personal perspective is. Right? All right, so we'll be back in about 2.5 minutes or so from right now.
Hun, what book are you reading?
It's a novel, kind of, about romance, love, and spiritual life in general.
Kind of a novel? What do you mean?
Well, it's based on some real-life experiences and even real characters. Some of their experiences are fascinating and remarkable. I can't put this book down.
How come the title is Afterlife Love?
That's part of the fascination. This book describes the afterlife in intricate detail and even explains why things are the way they're explained.
But how can anyone write about or know that?
Some of the characters travel out of body to some places that people who've already died also go to. I'm finding it completely believable because it all makes sense and fits into a bigger picture for me.
Hun, what happens to these people?
You can read it for yourself when I'm done if you want.
Better yet, I'll get my own copy so we can discuss it while we read. Let me see. I'll write down the title. It's Afterlife Love by Niles McFlower. M-A-C-F-L-O-U-E-R.
Afterlife Love is available in some bookstores and from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com or 480-966-3132. That's 480-966-3132.
Hi, everyone. Since childhood, I've had questions about my life and life in general that I couldn't find adequate answers to. Questions like, why am I here? Why are others here? Does the universe have a purpose? And how does that relate to my life? More recently, I've been wondering what happens when we die, especially the reasons why. I'm more of a doubter than a believer in many things, and answers that include the whys allow me to think and figure out the truth for myself. I've been reading a book, Life's Hidden Meaning. This one book contains more answers, including the whys, than all other sources I've read or heard. It's amazing to me that every one of my questions has been thoroughly answered. More importantly, I have found that all of these answers so far have checked out to be true. I hope this message helps some of you in your quest for better understanding. The name of this wonderful book is, again, Life's Hidden Meaning by metaphysician Niles McFlower. Some bookstores sell it. I got my copy directly from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Life's Hidden Meaning may enlighten your mind and bring some peace and joy to your heart.
We're back. This is Why Life Is. I'm your host, Niles McFlower. And in some ways, we are starting the show right now, because I kind of did about a 40-minute prologue about what we're going to really be discussing in tonight's show, which is the soul's prerogatives. And it's really the perspective of the soul in its actual ability to make a choice, and that choice is going to stick, because it's when the soul actually has the ability to directly influence the life form or forms that it ensouls. And so we need to be starting with that very idea. What does it mean? What is a soul in soul? What does that mean? And let's start with it from this perspective, okay? There would be no life if there were no souls. Life, as we understand life, is the expression of our Creator in lower dimensions of time and space, and the Creator chooses to express itself. As a matter of fact, the Creator virtually throughout the universe we exist in, has chosen to not be the primary source of self-expression. The only thing it expresses is this willingness, desire, and we'll say ability to create life. It says, let there be life. There is. And so, I mean, that is the key moment and expression of the Creator in every part of the universe. In its continuance, life is being constantly created. It's not done at some moment and then sort of carried out while the God of this universe is just sitting and watching, eating popcorn. No. The God of this universe is intimately involved in life as it is created, because that's the interesting part about being a God. And it gives God the greatest of all, we'll say, gifts, and that is the co-creation of the life that it creates with, and in some cases, the choice of much fewer parts of life to not co-create with God, but even to be destructive to life and God. I know that's crazy, it seems like, but God thought that type of freedom had to be allowed, or there would be no freedom for all life. Wow. Okay, so, that being the case, the soul is sort of an intermediary. Look at it from this standpoint. There are some things in life that need direct imposition upon the life. Those impositions keep life alive. Without them, the life will not successfully live very long, if at all, And the results are a nullification of the very first thing God wants, which is let there be life. So God says, I'll create things that will impose themselves to the most minimal level necessary just to keep life alive, to the least level that is interfering with the capabilities and therefore the responsibilities of each type of life and the form that the life is in. That's the basic rule. Okay? Did you get that rule? And you can see that rule is very sensible. I mean, there's no, it isn't like some kind of edict like I'm going to control the universe, ha ha ha, like evil says. It's the opposite. It's let's make it so that life can be allowed to be as free as it's capable of being. All right? If it's capable of being, capability is determined by keeping itself alive, oh, fine. You want to keep yourself alive and be an evil dude? Go do it. That's fine. But at the same time, when you can no longer keep yourself alive, something is going to come in and intervene. There are two parts of this. The soul is going to intervene, or God also introduced some laws. Oh, what are those laws? Well, the laws only involve themselves when the soul's capabilities are superseded, the soul itself. And the soul is superseded because, in most cases, the being, and usually this only involves humans, that is supposed to be informed by the soul, says, hey, soul, get lost. I'm going along with the group soul of evil. Okay, you have that choice. Fine. Go be with the group soul of evil. Now these laws enter in, which have to do with group souls of evil only, okay? And the laws are no different than the same laws that affect regular souls. But the difference being only in that when the choices end up being self-nullifying, which they almost always are, by the way, the results are that eventually, the being will succumb to the forces created by God creating a universe in which forces add up at greater and greater, infinitely greater levels eventually, against darkness or against things that are anti the thought of God or spiritual thought. And when that takes place, these forces, by their own doing, will become destructive evil. Well, you're going to say, so the universe is stacked. Yep, no doubt about it. Dice are stacked. But the point here is that if evil thinks it can really destroy God, go for it. Hey, you know, do it. It's obviously an illusion, and it's obviously confused. There's nothing to stop it except itself. Because eventually, the very thing that evil tries to create, which is chaos, produces, and that chaos only exists outside of God's, we'll call it God's virtue, God's light, is it embeds itself more into chaos and away from the light of God, which does the reverse. It creates, we'll call it, instead of chaos, organization, love, etc., all the virtues. When it does that, it eventually destroys itself. Not that God goes out with a vindictive sword and going to slice it and dice it and all that stuff. It's just that the forces themselves will do it. Wow. And that's what I mean by God's laws. It's not a law per se, like, you will be. No, it's just that chaos produces more and more infinitely larger, greater forces that are always going to destroy the evil ones. It's just the way the universe is made. And it's pretty cool, huh? Yeah, I know. If you think it through, it starts really, it has a lot of other sidelines to it. But for right now, okay. So the soul is given this prerogative, which again I call a prerogative because it's not just that the soul can think of something that, you know, wow, it's way beyond the consciousness of the human being. It has a right to exercise it as a choice. That's a prerogative. So that gives the soul a specific ability to do something, but only when it exceeds the capabilities of life form that the soul can intervene. So we need to understand that the soul, in its wisdom, and usually with other souls that are even greater than that soul, saying, yep, you're right, because the soul sometimes needs help from other souls. You're right, you go for it. In other words, it's being checked on. And because one soul could be obviously wrong, anything could be wrong. And so there's as much help in this as possible. It isn't a perfect system, but it's darn right close. And the result is the soul can say, hey, wait a second, this is beyond your capabilities. It's going to destroy your life if you continue in this way, and yet you are still connected to me. You're not evil. And so I'm going to try as best as possible to intervene here up to a certain level, up to the level that you're capable of making this choice and exercising. Now, if someone's capable of exercising the choice and it's wrong, the soul lets the person do it. But if they can't, then they will, in many circumstances, intervene. In some circumstances that aren't fatal to life, the soul stays out of it. So we're only talking about fatality here. So death and life become the big issues of the prerogatives of souls, death and life, but not necessarily smaller decisions like, oh, I think I'll have an ice cream cone today, or I'll have a peanut butter and jelly sandwich instead. Now, that all these kinds of things, the soul's not about. So realize it's only the biggies, the big issues, that the soul gets involved in its prerogatives. But there are different levels, and let's start with some of those levels. Souls for minerals. Now, there's a thing called a group soul for minerals. It's not even life. We call it pre-life, right? The chemistry of life, you know. What are they doing? I mean, you know, why is it even, why do they need a soul, for heaven's sake? I mean, they can't end a life because they're not life yet. Yeah, but they can do some things that might actually prevent life from developing, if you think about it. If certain chemicals were able to mix together when they shouldn't be able to mix together, life could end very quickly for a lot of things that are ahead of and more advanced, especially in the development of consciousness, than minerals are. So you could say, well, then you're saying that, you know, I'm saying that the chemistry of life is not just something that was made by God and that's it, you know. Souls have a certain level of ability to interact. How do we know that's true, though? Because since the time of the periodic table, we talk about the 18th century, and the discovery of many other aspects of, we'll say, science, as we have moved ahead, humanity has, what we have discovered is that although there certainly are laws governing the way that chemistry works, by electromagnetic forces mostly, not nuclear, a lot of people think that that's a whole other thing, but mostly electromagnetic, that for most of the science of chemistry, under natural and normal circumstances, there is a balance, we'll call it, that seems to support the existence of life. Well, you could say that that original concept was designed into much of the chemistry of the universe. Ah, but bring in human beings, you know, we always come up to work. And we change the environments of chemistry to the point by changing the electrical component. We change the way some chemicals not normally found together are deliberately introduced together in quantities that they could never be in nature. We change the temperatures, the power or energy levels. We make them very cold, we make them very hot, we change them this way or that. We create things called plasmas, which are only around stars, and we make them right here on Earth. We do all kinds of stuff. And those things can lead to a, we'll call it, a very deadly outcome, or very strange, and we'll call it non-life-producing outcome that could contaminate all kinds of other sources. So you do need to have a group soul to, in some ways, limit that process. You can say, well, how can a group soul interfere with a plasma or with us trying to prevent this chemical from reaching that chemical at this temperature and this electrical component and change the all the different factors about it? How does that, how, what can a group soul do? I mean, it's, human beings are intervening, right? We're kind of in charge over that group soul in some respects. Well, this is the odd part about it. That group soul communicates with the soul of the human. And the human soul and the alter ego of the human soul, which is called the, we'll call it the angel or angelic part of the human soul. So all of this is communicated. Whoa, it's communicating behind the scenes and we don't know it. Yep. And if we're not evil, there's a feedback mechanism that comes back to the human being saying, hey, you know, this is really dangerous. And what you're trying to create here, if it gets away from you or if others find out about it, this could be a serious, serious problem. Maybe you should either outwatch yourself or prevent other people from knowing about it or make a general rule that this can't do this sort of stuff. And sure enough, some humans do this, and sure enough, some societies do this, and even some massive groups of governments have done this. Yeah, like making poison gases or changing the relationship of some things that nobody even knows about because they're so dangerous they never even told anybody. So you see, there, this is an amazing thing. And if you didn't have this feedback process, we wouldn't know about it. So the souls of minerals help the soul to inform the souls of humans that something's awry here in the lower realms. And the human soul wouldn't know anything about it because the human soul doesn't have direct contact with those, the chemistry. And then all of a sudden, the human soul has to communicate with us through a means that's kind of roundabout, using our conscience and certain other elements. And the more conscious people actually get more direct contact with their souls. They tell them this is really bad. And so they then bring it to the attention of many other people, but maybe secretively, and let them know that this is a really serious dilemma and we've got to be more careful about this. The same is true of lower forms of life, like viruses. These, many of these things, and certain types of bacteria and fungi, many of these things can be weaponized or changed into dangerous things that should be prevented. And so the souls of those things are involved. Now, those kinds of things are usually in between kingdoms, but they're still part of one kingdom and the other together. And they're still, now, those are actually living. Viruses are right on the edge, but they're usually into the living category, away from where the minerals were. Still the same concept, still the same thing. Wow, you didn't know that's going on. From the soul's perspective, this is a big deal. From us, we are just oblivious in many circumstances until our soul contacts us and boom, bingo, bango, a few people who are more conscious say, hey, this is really serious. We can't continue this. We're going to have to try to do something to limit this. And they work on it, and they try. Sometimes they're successful, sometimes they're not. Remember, when they're not successful, dangerous things are afoot. Evil could get a hold of this and do terrible stuff. All right, so this is a cool idea now, if you think about it, because we have the soul on one side trying to support God and life, except for the soul of evil, not the group soul thing. And humanity kind of like oblivious in some respects, in the more conscious parts of humanity, which are the definite in minority at the present time on Earth, you know, saying, whoa, we have a problem because we're getting the messages from the souls because they have more soul contact. Consciousness means more soul contact, more capabilities to do something to change the situation and alter and correct it for those who are not so conscious and maybe, you know, sitting in a laboratory somewhere and saying, oh, this is very interesting. This is only the most fatal thing we can do. Oh, we shouldn't have to worry about that, right? And of course, they're, oh, yeah, we've got to worry about that. Yeah, absolutely. When humans can alter the lower kingdoms, and they have the capability of doing so, they become responsible for those lower kingdoms and the outcomes. And the first people to die from their mistakes the first living things to die from their mistakes in any mass way, has been designed by the human soul to be humans. Now, let me repeat that again so you understand. Human souls, in their prerogatives, they decide life and death. Remember that. They decide by weeding certain ways that humans behave and others, and we'll get into this later in the show, they decide that humans, more than any other life form, are going to pay for the mistakes of humans by costing the life of humans first before, in percentage, not in numbers, but in percentage of life, other forms of life die earlier. And you can say, well, what, haven't we erased whole genetic lines in some animals and plants? Yeah, we have. But in percentage, not as much as it will ultimately affect a human being. I know that's hard to understand because from my perspective, we don't really see all of the intricacies of what we're doing. So please bear with me on this. I know if you just superficially look at it, it doesn't seem that way, but it is. It's designed that way from the soul's prerogative. Human life will end earlier. There will be less people eventually born and less humans on Earth. And the kind of life we can even live within the shorter time we live within will be diminished. The choices we can make, our capabilities, expression, and creation will be diminished by the terrible mistakes that we make in the lower kingdoms in our civilizations. That's it. That's the way. And the souls are behind the scenes making sure that that basic premise is withheld. It's held up. Why? Because if we can't learn by the positive side of being good, protecting, creating life, then they want us to learn, souls and God wants us to learn, by our own destruction. And outside of evil, this planet is very self-protected. Evil can change the whole thing. Because it's our soul that causes us to get diminished in life, the evil soul does the opposite. It tries to get us to live longer and live stronger by stealing power from all other life, including other humans, and who are living in the light or trying to. And that soul is given the right to do that. It can. That's where the problem lies. Evil upsets the balance so that humans can't destroy under evil the life of much else in the world, including human life, and do so without the interference, they would call it interference, without the protection of human souls and their prerogatives. Now you can see why evil is so dangerous, because the safeguard that keeps everything nicely in balance and works really well is removed by the free choice of evil souls, which are group soul, and the free choice of people, humans, who choose to become part of that group soul's process and thinking and actions. Okay. Are you with me on this so far? I told you this is going to get deep, right? I know it's deep, I know. But remember, I'm still standing that I'm only going to do about 40 minutes on this deep stuff, you know, so we're about halfway there, you know. And again, I'm going to try to give you kind of a breather and just sort of, you know, just take it easier here and there and whatever. So I just thought that would be an interesting thing to do. And also, you should also remember that by going longer, you can also, you know, re-listen to parts of the show if you have any problem with it. I wanted to mention, if you haven't had a chance, you could stop by the Eye Center and see Dr. David Stacy. He's an OD. Talk to Lorraine and Christy over there, his assistants. And the reason I recommend that you, if you need any, we'll say, vision adjustment by contact lenses, glasses, etc. The reason to go see him is because he does things that specialists who normally charge 3, 4, 5 times as much do, which is to work with people to try to get the best vision possible instead of just, well, here's a pair of glasses, you're out the door. If you just think you need only a pair of glasses, you could go anywhere. But a lot of people, I think much more than people realize, a lot of people need more time spent with them to be able to get their vision to the point where they're really happy with it. Not everybody cares about that. If you don't, then it won't matter to you. But for those who do, I find that he really will work with you without charging an arm and a leg for it, and that's really the cool part. And he's not so inaccessible. The people that charge a lot also don't work as much, I think, because it's very hard to get an appointment with them. Okay, so at any rate, he's over at 2974 North Amos School Road over in Suite 3. That's in Chandler. It's on the southwest corner of Amos School and Elliott in the Phoenix area. If you're in the Phoenix area, of course, this is for you to know. If you're not in the Phoenix area, look for someone like him where you live, because there are other people besides him who are more prone to spend time, even though it's more costly for them, to get people to see really correctly. Believe me, when it comes to contact lenses, this is no easy deal. And I'll tell you right now, contact lenses is still an art. It's not just a science trying to get someone to see right with them. I like contact lenses because I think people see better with them. You get about 10% more light through a contact lens than you do through glasses. Is that important? Well, that's how we see. Yeah, if you get more light, you're going to have better vision. What else do you see better with? Well, and there's also less reflection, which is another issue about how much light you get at night, particularly. And peripheral vision is improved with contact lenses in almost zero amount with glasses, which for some people can make a huge difference in driving. You see a car coming up on your side better, where a lot of accidents happen in lane changes. So contact lenses have inherent improvements in vision that is built into the way that it's used in the eye. There are other parts of contact lenses that it can help. Some semi-hard ones can actually keep vision from getting worse. But there's a lot of other factors. You have to be careful. You've got to be a person who is, you know, keeps your, sanitary issues up and other things so you don't get infections in your eye. You don't overwear them. There's a schedule. A lot of stuff like that. You got to be aware of when your eyes are too dry or when they're not, when a contact lens should be taken out because of some irritation or something. All that becomes incumbent upon the wearer, and I don't know that everybody can wear contact lenses because of that. Some people are just, no matter how much better they might see, it's just not good, right for them. It's not right for their lifestyle and who they are. So these are all kinds of things that, or I think contact lenses is good, bad, and sometimes somewhere in between. And glasses, though. Certain kinds of glasses are better than others for people with multiple kinds of vision problems, but not everybody can wear those kinds of glasses either. So there's a lot of factors to get in. Some of them are called progressive lenses. And a lot of people, their brain just can't adjust correctly to them. And sometimes that can be bypassed or improved upon, but there's a lot of work to get that to that point. And not all eye doctors are willing to spend that kind of time and just get a pair of glasses from somebody. Okay, the Eye Center, theeyecenter.org, you can check out that place. And again, if you're not in the Phoenix area, you can find somebody like Dr. Stacy, probably around where you live. And maybe if you could even call him. I'll give you the phone number. You ready? 480-899-0188. 480-899-0188. Mention this show and say, hey, I heard it on this guy's show, and he said, you know. And if you're not in this area, he might be able to help you find somebody who will assist you with the kind of problem you have. Okay, so let's go back to tonight's show, The Soul's Prerogatives. All right, that's what the show's about. So where else does the soul was mostly exercises as prerogatives around the issues of life and death. When you're born and when you die, it's a big deal. But what is in between that? I mean, when does a soul exercise its prerogative? And what kind of prerogatives can it deal with besides just killing you and getting you born? I mean, there has to be more than that, right? Because those are extreme measures. And for the most part, those are the biggies. In other words, that you really can't, you know, you can try to negotiate this with the soul. But most people, when they're doing that, they're in a manipulative fashion, and I don't think it's going to be too, it's not going to work the way you might want it to work. Okay, and you definitely won't find that praying for something about your personal self is probably going to do much good for you and may have negative consequences. I'm just letting you know about that because I think some people sometimes believe something other than that. Okay, so when does a soul, what are the prerogatives in between those two extremes does the soul exercise itself in? When a person is in a highly creative, by its own doing, and his or her own doing, is highly creative and is doing something that, unbeknownst to that person, can lead to some serious harmful consequences. The soul intervenes. Now, who in the heck is it doing? I mean, is it going to just pop up one day and say, "I am your soul, and by the way, I want to let you know"? No, it doesn't use those methods. These are the methods that it uses. It uses mental dreams. Now, what's a mental dream compared to an astral dream? Well, mental dreams repeat themselves multiple times. So if you can remember, like, yeah, I had that dream five times in a row, but each time it changed a little bit, that's a mental dream. That's a sign of it, anyway. If you're learning something, someone's lecturing you, teaching something, explaining something, that's a sign the soul is trying to communicate with you through a mental dream. What else? Besides mental dreams, the soul does so while you're being creative. It will introduce a thought that in some way complicates or creates a ulterior outcome to the creative process by a, we'll call it, suggestion from your higher mind. So it can't be a specific, it will not be a specific thing it tells you to do. You suddenly get a concept about what you're doing that runs counter to the outcome if the soul wants to intervene. And you say, what about that? I didn't think about that before, but that concept may not be in accord with what. And so that is a sign of intervention by the soul. It only can intervene from higher concepts, and the higher concepts almost always will not involve the personal, selfish concepts of what are called the K3 pedal, which is, it won't involve where the personality creates most of its concepts. This would be a uniquely outside-of-the-box personal concept, something that goes into something brand new. And you say, where did it come from? I thought of it. It just came in my head. You can introduce a thought that is conceptual and beyond the personal interest level. And that thought sometimes is contradictory to what you've been doing in your creations. And it always has to be connected to a creative effort. If you are not creative, the soul can't use the methods I just suggested. Sometimes it can introduce an astral dream if you're not creative. And the astral dream will result in a terrifying nightmare or some type of apprehension or some type of trepidation in the night, in the dream itself. Maybe it won't be a nightmare, maybe just a disturbing dream. Those kinds of dreams don't generally repeat themselves, but they wake you up. Or when you awaken, you say, oh, that was not fun at all. That if the soul can do, okay. What else can the soul do? The soul can cause you to have an accident by briefly interrupting a sense or two that you're using, causing you to make a goofy mistake. Now, a goofy mistake almost always is planned to get you to notice something that's wrong in your creative thinking. Are you hearing me? You didn't know souls could do that? Okay, I know. Those pesky souls are always doing something. Yeah. Now, this is rare, because the soul doesn't like to intervene in the physical world using your physical senses. But it will, if absolutely necessary, to correct something that is really seriously going awry and that you're going to cause some harm to a lot of other folks. It will not usually intervene just to protect you from hurting yourself. But from hurting other people, it will. And especially larger groups of people and other life forms. Be aware of that. This you might see when you normally wouldn't have an accident and you did. This minor accident you had might have hurt yourself. You broke an arm, a leg, or something. But if you had continued down the road the way we were driving, you would have killed 50 people or 100 people. Yeah, you're starting to see what I'm talking about. You getting it? I'm just giving you an example there so that you could follow what I'm talking about now. So souls have their ways. Hey, look, they're not so impotent as we might think. They try not to exercise these options unless you're doing things with your own capabilities. They don't think you're going to make it in terms of correcting the issue, and lots of people may be harmed. And they know you don't want to harm the people. There's no intentional issue here, because then you would be moving into the evil side, and the soul wouldn't have the right, much less the capability, to achieve its goal, because you're blocking the soul and or rejecting it. So this is the whole point of what I'm getting at. Now, how do souls interfere with your senses? There's a thing that the soul can do. It involves the energy called chi. Well, you know about that. I talk about it all the time, right? And if it wants, the chi causes a condition called maya. When the chi is held within the body and isn't being exchanged from the body to the outside world continually, and it's held in the body and in too much of one place, it darkens that place. It literally creates an energy field around the place called maya. And literally it looks dark. And the soul can briefly flood the maya from one place of the body to another, causing a sense to fail and an accident, as we call it, to occur, or a lack of, we'll call it, sense to happen in the physical body. It can actually do this. You say, whoa, that's kind of scary. How does it do it? It's energy follows thought greater than its own. The soul's thought from the higher mental world is so great that it actually can focus on the dense physical body, and for a very brief period of time, not very long, it can cause too much energy to accumulate in one place or another. Only if it's dark energy and only if it's the maya. And it does it just for seconds to a minute or two, because it doesn't have the capability of doing much more than that. And it does it only when the accident or things that we call an accident are going to in some way improve the situation in the long run, even though it may cause some harm to us personally. And so that's what it does. It uses that methodology. It's using its thought all the way from the mental world to affect something in a very minimal way, the chi. We say, well, how can I do that? Well, because it uses mental chi. There is such a thing as mental chi, which corresponds to the mental, to the astral, the physical world, excuse me, chi, and that chi then has an effect on the other chi in the lower body. And it knows exactly how many seconds and minutes it needs to do it beforehand, because it actually has to do that. A calculation about to achieve the result. It's not easy to do. It's very difficult to do, and the soul has to have way more consciousness than most humans have to even be able to do this. It is even assisted in doing such things by the solar angel, which has even much more consciousness and thinking ability to achieve the goal. Some of it's pure math. It's just kind of really advanced ideas in math to be able to figure out the exact timing and everything. All right. So that being the case, we have a kind of paradigm, an example of how this whole system is designed so that souls can keep us going, hey, and they can achieve tremendous results with very little action, actually. It doesn't take a lot to, in the right circumstances, to get someone to awaken to something they're making an error about in their thought and their behavior. And if their heart is in the right place, they want to create some light, but they don't realize what they're doing is so not so good. This is the way the soul works. There's still always the conscience. The conscience only works when the person would know better and is pushing away the right choice. Many people don't even know better. They're just completely ignorant, we'll say. The illusions are so great in their mind. They don't got it. It's not a personal thing like, oh, gee, I don't care about whether I hurt somebody. They do care. They just can't put it all together. Those are the more complicated circumstances. Just conscience alone will not change that. You've got to be something a lot more than just dealing with a person's conscience to be able to solve that problem. These are the ways that souls do that. And they work together on this. Human souls almost always work with their solar angel, and the solar angels work with many other solar angels of other souls. And so it's a collaborative issue, but it's still an individual choice of the individual soul to initiate it and for the human being on an individual level to accept and respond to it. Fascinating. Individuality combined with group consciousness in just an amazingly balanced way. Why does it work that way? Well, because souls, unlike human beings, are balanced between their sense and their thought. They have a balance. So they tend to work in ways that are much less mistake-ridden and much more conscious-ridden. And then in addition to that, depending upon the level of development of the soul, it is also balanced at a certain level of balance between the creative part of the soul and the giving, loving part of the soul, which is consciousness. Those two are balanced at a certain level. The level is reduced for the type of soul it is. The group souls have a very low level of both creation and the ability to give. And the human soul has a very high level of creation and ability to give. And they try to keep that within balance. They aren't 100% all the time in that. But they're much better in keeping balance between their senses and their overall thought process. So between all of these elements, the soul is a way superior being in its overall capability of co-creating with God in comparison to the human. But the soul doesn't have a big deal, and that is it doesn't have direct senses and direct interactions in the three worlds that human beings inhabit, because the soul ain't here. The human is, and that's the reason it creates a human being, as its surrogate to go into the lower worlds, but it knows that that surrogate will become quite illusioned, and its senses and its thoughts will be in defiance to some of the ideas and will of its creator, which is God. The soul is way closer to God, but it doesn't have the ability to co-create with God in the lower realms where it creates a human being to do this. Or, in the case of lower life forms, where the group souls are doing this on a larger scale, but from almost zero individuality, because they're very limited in their creative capacity outside of for large groups. It's so easy to create for large groups because you depend upon the averages. But as far as individuality, it's very, very hard to create that way. You got to have way more ability to use all seven ray energies and all seven senses. And life forms below human don't use all seven senses. And so you get into all kinds of limitations, and group souls are very limited in comparison to a human soul. And so group souls have an easier experience because they base it on averages. Therefore, a lot more of their species dies that they are helping at a particular time, but on an average, they get things done. With the human soul, they keep each individual together much more individually creative and can live longer in general, but they also can't touch more than just a human being except through the connection between the solar angel that's helping them and the other souls that are there. And in some, the more advanced human souls actually can communicate with each other on a moment-to-moment basis. Now, that's a real gift. But when they get to that level, they're developing a thing called Buddha consciousness and are starting to function more from the first level, very top of the mental world, instead of isolated in one little place in the second tier or place in the mental world. So they're more advanced souls, and they create more advanced humans, of course. And they only can communicate very well with the souls of humans that are as conscious as they are and as their soul, as their human is. So you find those kinds of humans work together well, but they don't necessarily work very well with the humans of souls that are less conscious, and the humans themselves are much less conscious. There may be a schism between them. So you see this in society. Conscious people tend to be able to work better together, but they can't seem to get the masses of people who many times are much less conscious to do much of anything, because they say, oh, I don't want to listen to those goofballs, or all some kind of goofy people we don't like. Okay, so they get ostracized to some extent in their, because of their consciousness, not because they're bad people or done anything wrong or anything like that. Okay, so we're kind of getting there. You see, we're really there, aren't we? We're kind of getting to the point where we have some foundations now, understanding how souls have prerogatives and the limitations that human souls particularly have. Now let's talk about some examples and some ways that we can probably apply all this, because this is a big deal, and you've obviously never heard me talk about it at this level, right? Yeah, this is a new show, Soul Prerogatives. Okay, I didn't know they had prerogatives. Yeah, that's absolutely true. And now let's go into this question of examples, because we've pretty much covered some of the basics of the soul's prerogatives. But now we want to get into, how does this exemplify itself? How does it make it so that we can take this information that I'm teaching tonight and use it in a practical sense? Because, after all, many of you who are listening to me fall closer to that area where you want to have a soul that's more advanced, where you want to help that soul to communicate better with its solar angel and other solar angels of other souls, and you want to really have a life that is closer to being a co-creator with God, and you want to have a life that is meaningful. And for you, meaningful life means trying to function more and more like your soul while you're separated from it in the lower dimensions of time and space. So that's what really the rest of tonight's show is going to be. How can we be our soul while we're here? And it's in another dimension that's so difficult for us to even conceive of, much less do anything that's like there, right? All right, so what are the ways of doing this? Well, again, this is something that has to be enacted by raising the capacity of the human being and not the soul. The soul is far enough advanced, so it, as we raise our consciousness, it automatically moves without, almost effortlessly, in higher consciousness as we do so here. So we don't have to really worry about our soul. That's not the problem. We have to worry about us. All right. So the first thing is motive, and connected to desire, which is an aspect of the astral nature. Motive comes from our conceptual framework. Do we think more like the soul, or do we think more like a person, a personality? You want to get off of the ism scale, where you're dealing with communism and you're dealing with capitalism, or those kinds of logic thought processes are connected through personal interests. Instead, you want to get into what is the way that is best to help others become enlightened. Well, there's some real simple formulas for that. Enlightenment is best developed by increasing people's creative choices while their ability to exercise those choices helps others to do the same. If those two things are put together, then you have a real model for creating a life that is going to operate as a co-creator of God. Now, it sounds like a simple thing. Well, that doesn't sound so hard. Yeah, okay. Here's the difficulty with that. The darn personality of most people is seeking to do almost the opposite. Not because it's a bad thing, but because it was created to be a controlling entity until we could, on our own, supersede it through a self-structure that wants to be more like the soul. And just says to the personality, oh, hey, wait a second, buddy. You're basically second seat now. You're not the thing that's going to guide me or that's going to control me. And the problem with this is the personality was created so that the first 10 years of life or so, humans could have literally help from preconceived elements that come from a personal interest. And it adopts what I call the ism principle. It adopts certain philosophies from its environment that it believes will operate for it in thought, so it doesn't have to come up with new ideas itself. Before 10, we don't have the capability of doing that. And so the personality up to about 10 years old, depending upon the consciousness of the person, is the boss. Why am I doing? Because mommy and daddy tell me so. The Bible told me so. My teacher told me so. I read it in this book. It told me so. I saw it on Sesame Street. It told me so. That's what kids at that age group and younger are doing. There's nothing wrong with that. Because without those preconceived concepts, they might do all kinds of bad things. So the soul the personality is needed to be in control. Otherwise, we would have a chaotic young group of people who don't have anything to rely on because they don't have the capability to think beyond that point, and what they have is then just nothing. And then it's a fill in the blank, and the blank always tends towards some kind of disorganized, even evil way. You want kids to become evil, remove all of those issues that they get from their parents and school and religion, TV, some good stuff on TV, and they do terrible things then. Yeah, they can even become sociopathic or worse. So, I mean, it's seriously a big problem, and you don't want that to happen. You don't. Instead, what you do is you allow them to grow to the point of capability. This could happen at 7, 8, 9, 10, even a little later in some people, up to 11 or 12 or 13. But it happens where they start creating their own mental concepts that go beyond that which they were just taught. Through synthesis to begin with, and then eventually through creative imagination and within a short time, usually by 16, 17 years old, they're starting to do it in the higher mental world. Wow. So as you can see how this is all developed. And it's usually by about age 21 that in the higher mental world, they have truly created new concepts from all that they've been taught and learned and all that they created before and experimented with. And then it takes them another 7 years to put those new concepts into some kind of action in their life. But at any rate, I'm just talking in generalities. These numbers don't necessarily hold to every human being on Earth. These are general things. All right, so let's look at how this takes place then. We need our personality to be in control up to a certain age, because we don't have the capability in our mental development to connect our mental senses to all the other bodies and to live our life in a creative way using anything other than what we've been taught. and anything other than by rote means. So the problem is, if you say, well, what is the best way to teach kids? Well, the best way to teach kids is through rote learning until about age 6 or 7, and then by gradually reversing the process of rote learning to creative learning from that point forward, gradually increasing creative learning until the personnel, and it has to be individually based, the personnel, yes, some of you are going to say, Montessori, okay, yeah, she had it right. What am I going to tell you? Now, she was a spiritual disciple. Yeah, Montessori, absolutely. And she used some of the same guidelines, the same ideas. Yeah, but they aren't understood and exercised in every Montessori school. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying she had it right. Yeah, no doubt about it. Okay, so that's an aside, but some of you may not even have heard that name before, and it doesn't matter. If you want to look it up, it might be helpful. But the point is that, yes, you want to reach a point where you're gradually, I mean, not instantly, here's all these new ways you're going to create and throw away everything you ever learned before. No, you don't want to do that. Check everything out. Test it. What you learned through rote, what you copied from others, now needs to be modified to be you. You are creating yourself. We are all self-created beings, humans, you see. And so this process now unfolds. Now, how does this get into the prerogative of the soul? If it's done correctly, while the person is being reversed from the rote process to the creative process, and more creation is taking place in what is called the higher mind, above the personal concepts that the personality latches onto mostly through rote learning, now the person starts truly creating herself. The lower self at first. And more as their self is created, they become unique. No longer a mouthpiece for their parents, religion, country, this or that, right? Or school. They become themselves. This process is supposed to continue until age 21. On average. When you get to age 21, the person should have created enough of their lower self. Now, from 21 to 28, they're going to start creating their higher self. That's the idea, anyway. Now, the higher self is a bit different in this situation, because a person in the original context was only trying to create more of their individuality. Now, they have to create more of their group conscious or soul self, to balance their level of capability and individuality. The two should be virtually identical in balance together by the age of 28, if they're doing everything right. This should be what our highest educational goals should be. That's not the case in most places, but it should be. And so that unfolds the soul in the person. From 21 to 28, you're really working almost exclusively outside of what's called the third tier of the mental body, and you're exclusively into the second and first tier of thinking. You're thinking as a soul from 21 to 28, more and more. And you're disciplining yourself in a spiritual sense from 21 to 28, whereas the discipline before that was more personal discipline and more lower self-development. This allows the soul's prerogatives to become functional through the human being here in the physical world while that person is living. Are you with me on this? Now you could say, well, that's a pretty big model. Why didn't you tell us about that before? I did. It's in the first chapter of Life and Meaning. I know that most people have read this if they read that book, but the problem is, knowing and understanding are two different things. Well, I knew about it. I didn't understand what you just said. I understand that. Yes, I got it. Just as those people who are at the age of 21 don't understand it until they're 28. They don't. Now, people who vote and are between the ages of 18 or 21, but most of them are 18, and 28 have a real difficult problem. problem because they vote on so many issues that are lower self-controlled. They're still on the third tier. They're in the spiritual part of the third tier if they're well-developed people, but the spiritual part of the third tier isn't the soul. It's the higher part of the lower self. And from that perspective, they can't vote on seeing soul issues. And that's why people who run for office can play upon those particular people under 28. It's easier for them to manipulate and control their thought processes in ways that are maybe obscene because they may be against the soul, but unfortunately, that people may not know that. This happened to a much larger extent for the first time that I'm aware of in 2008 in the presidential election. A vast number of these people voted. In the past, they would restrain themselves from voting because they just simply didn't care enough. And that's a good thing, by the way, in some respects, because if you get a dude in office, or anybody in office, it could be a woman too, but it's usually going to be a guy, who really is looking towards control and manipulation and wants a lot of power and maybe is anti-American, you got all these things coming together. These folks are not going to necessarily see that. They're more easily preyed upon. But don't listen, just blame it on them. A whole country was fooled by hope and change. He didn't tell you what to hope or change to. Hope and change. Well, he did. He said he was going to get rid of corruption, and he's the most corrupt president we've had in the last 100 years or more. He said he was going to get rid of other stuff. Those kinds of things were easy for us to bypass and not see, because although a lot of people over 28 are more soul conscious, a far greater number, if you're talking about the total percentages or not. And if you tap into the right in the right way, you can even get elected president by just lying and being a good actor, reading a prompter good, and being able to prey on what people desire without really bypassing the reason capabilities or thoughts on a higher scale by getting their desires to be so strong. Their desire is to have a minority president, to maybe get rid of all this bullshit about prejudice in this country. The desire is to have a president who is seeking, by his statements, to get rid of corruption, to have a president who will work on both sides of the aisle and get people to really focus on what's good and right for everyone. Well, obviously, that didn't happen. A president who will take responsibility, make sure that Congress, as an example, passes a budget they're supposed to. A person who is president who exhibits a very hard and strong spiritual side. Well, that's obviously lacking. So, I mean, you got these issues, but the point is that people have the desires for those things, and they latch on to the statements and or inferences made to convince them that this person is that way, a great orator. He has a tone of voice which suggests that it's in compliance with what he says, but it never matches his actions, or almost never matches his actions. These are the problems. People can get fooled. And remember this, because so many people that are beyond the age of 28 never do develop this connection with their soul. Why is that the case? Well, it's a case on Earth. Earth has been permeated by evil. Evil blocks us in a whole bunch of ways. I don't really want to get into that tonight, but it has a whole bag of tricks, some of them I just talked about Obama, but they're much greater than that. And the tricks are so, we'll say, effective for the majority of people that we are in grave danger of a not to say there aren't evil women, but if you're looking for evil, 9 times out of 10, it's going to be a male. Okay, so what do we do? What do we do about this? Because here we're running this grave danger that we have people that don't pass, they get past 28, but they're still messed up. They're in their personal interests. They're not evil people. They may be selfish. They're not evil. But they're not connected to their soul enough. The soul is trying. Believe me, the soul is trying by doing all the little mistake things. But it can't on its own. Cannot on its own achieve the results that I know people who are listening to this show would like the soul to achieve. What is the answer to this? The answer is everybody who's listening to me, everybody who's ever read this stuff, everybody who believes in some of what I'm saying, you need to go out and talk to other people about it. Oh, I know, but they'll tell me I'm kooky. I listen to the McFlower guy. He's a goofball. You know, he's some wacko crazy guy on the radio. Yeah, I understand that it may personally cause you some embarrassment, grief, people rejecting you as a person. Maybe they won't invite you to the next party or whatever. You're going to have some things like that. Let's all accept that. I do. But the point is that though that's a really small discomfort in comparison to the good. The good is if you talk to everybody you can. I mean, just plain, I don't care if it's on the bus or first time you ever met somebody in the grocery store and you have a discussion, bring it up. Not immediately. I mean, you don't have to say, well, hi, I'm here to talk to you about, have you been connected to your soul today? No. Talk to them about a lot of stuff. First, get some kind of connection with them established. Otherwise, yeah, then they're going to think you really are a nutcase. But there's so many people you already know, at least on some level, that you never told them what you think or feel. They don't even know about this show, right? Oh, I couldn't tell them I listened to you. Look, there's a lot of people out there listening to me. Tell them. Hey, how many people have you not told about you listening to the show or reading something I wrote or reading something someone else wrote, but it's still the same stuff, right? That's, how many times has that been? Yeah, a lot, huh? Oh, okay. Gotcha, right? That's what the soul expects of you. You say, oh, no, that's what you expect. No, I'm just a messenger, honestly. I think I am anyway. The soul expects us to communicate with others about our co-creations, our beliefs, who we really are. And most people don't. That's the biggest problem today. Numero uno of all the problems that exist is that one. If we change that one problem, Obama doesn't get elected. I know that's maybe, some of you may not be what you want, but that's what happens. And the possibility of this planet going completely evil almost stops. How could that be? I'm not talking, the problem is that everybody listens to me on the radio. No, maybe you got that mixed up. No, I'm talking about that. That was just an example. The problem is that you're not expressing to others your firm understanding that there is a soul, that the soul, that you're an emissary of your soul and of their soul as well. And you're here to try to get them to understand that there is a bigger reason that they live here. It's the soul's prerogatives that are so critical. It's the soul's thought that this person needs to hear about, and you are the emissary to provide some of the information. You are the little teacher about to go into the vast ranges of human, we'll say, illusion and try to do your best. You don't have to teach everything. You can get other people to listen, to read. And then open discussion. Always open discussion to whatever people are willing to talk about. Don't force them, but bring it up every time you're together. Hey, have you been reading that? Oh, you haven't? Well, let me tell you what I've been reading. Oh, you have? Tell me more about what you think about it. That's what you need to be doing. And that's what's not getting done. The soul is relying upon that at this point because it's in a weird position. Human beings have reached the ability to think from the higher tier, the second and first tier, think from the higher minimal. But we're capable, but we choose not to because of a thing called egotism. The tisms, remember I told you the tism is the problem? Well, egotism incorporates all the tisms. So it's the tism that becomes the nature of the person. They never gave up the tisms. They're still 10 years old or younger. Yeah. Those people who are really egotistical that you meet that don't want to talk to you, they're still locked in their personality. That doesn't mean you give up on them. It just means that you understand who they are. Oh, they're 10 years old. They have enormous fears to adopt your side of the fence because they have to give up what mommy and daddy told them, what their teachers told them, what their religion told them. Those things were very important at one time. It was the rote, and the rote became the egotism. Now, some of them became egotistical at age 20. It doesn't have to be just a 10. As long as they stay 10, they continue to grow in the egotism. The tisms come from, again, the fear of venturing into one's own development of self beyond what they've been told or read. Well, how do I know? The Bible told me so. How do I know? I went to graduate school and I became a scientist. I know. You see, you have to open the door to the bigger world of ideas and concepts beyond that of the tisms into a new world of open-mindedness and creative thought. You don't have to always be right, and they don't have to be right. You have to be open to new things, as the soul is. When humans stop being creative, they're going backwards into the animal kingdom. Eventually, they lose part of their connection with the soul because the soul wants them to be creative, and they become non-creative. So they're actually almost treating their soul like it's a group soul rather than a human soul. A very devastating thing in terms of the development of a closer relationship with the soul. You can stop that as part of the equation. Isn't that a wonderful idea? I think it's amazing that we have such simple things we can do to make such a big difference for all. What else? Well, that's the biggie. I mean, if you really, you know, you want to say, what's the big the biggest thing we can do? That's the biggest because almost everybody can do it. Everything I'm going to talk about from this point forward are more specifics. Some people can and some people can't. Their capability level is really the issue. So don't think that everybody I'm going to say can do everything I'm going to continue to enumerate and express until we end tonight's show. Let me go on. Of course, normally we'd be signing off right now, but we're going to continue. That's the luxury we got tonight, thanks to the station. Thank you, Nathan. Station. Okay. So the next thing that could be actually more effective for some people, but not on as big a scale, is to start forming a spiritual get-together, a group of people that think in common mode to yourself and that try to exercise some kind of project or some kind of, we'll say, specialness that is really based upon a spiritual thought or thoughts that will cause people to not only talk about and think about, but actually to take action. This requires some level of spiritual discipline now, And it also means when you're taking action, you're actually going to be doing the work of the soul here. And you take this responsibility by letting people know you're starting a group of people that do this. It's not some kind of wacko group of people who are, you know, have some ism. It's a group of people who want to make the world a little more enlightened. And that's, you know, you can say, well, it's a humanitarian. Okay, sure, it's that. You can say, well, it's also spiritual. Yeah, well, although that word makes sense. Spirit is the thought of God. It's all spiritual thought that way. Well, spiritual thought that is enlightened is. It's the spiritual thought that has become dark and then it's separated from God. So it depends how you want to look at it. But you want spiritual thought that's enlightening, right, to be part of your group thought. You can also get the help of other people to help you do this. You know, you can call me. People that I know will help you. I will help you too, but in this pursuit. You can further this process by advertising, formally letting people know what you're interested in and if they have an interest of similar. And it needs to be a creative interest, not rote things. It's got to be something that you've come up with that really you think is an area that you could be helping, you want to know, and you're interested in, if other people are interested in it. Make it general enough so that other people will want to become part of it, and make it specific enough so that you can introduce what you have as a part of it. Sound like a good formula? Yes. Does this have a greater level of responsibility and more effort and more money and more time than the first thing I said? Yeah. Each one of these things is going to require much more than the very first. The first thing actually will do more if everybody did it, but these will do more because everybody isn't going to do it, the first one. So this will make some compensation. We can make up for those that aren't going to do what I suggested on the first. This is number two. This number two is a biggie. There are different kinds of groups. You can read about them in the textbook. There are groups that just serve other groups in a sense. They support the bigger parts of, we'll call it spiritual planning. And then there are groups that do things more on a national level. That's, you know, for a whole country, that's a lot more effort. And then there's groups that work for the whole world in some way. That's really hard to do. And most of the people that are going to be in a World Service group have usually in some lifetime, maybe this one, but in some lifetime, been in groups of the other kind before, less demanding ones. Groups that work more on the group service model last about 2 to 5 years. Don't expect they're going to last forever. You have to form a new one after that time. Groups on a national level last 5 to 20 years, 25 years. And groups of the world nature can go all the way through and beyond a whole lifetime into other dimensions of reality and life, and even when you come back in another incarnation. Okay, so all these things become a process, let's say, that we can all share and do something about. Now, you might say, well, how do I get these other people to respond? Well, they do or they don't. But you make sure they're aware, you make sure they're informed. You put out in various ways on the internet or newspaper or whatever you want to do, what you're doing, let people know. Maybe put up some even posters in certain places. But you let them know. The internet makes it even easier these days, so I think that would be a good place to start. But you can choose how you want to do it. And then your own word of mouth. Let people know. Generally it takes about 3 people to get a group going. That's all. The group service groups, they can get into thousands of people. National service groups in the hundreds. World service groups are usually 12 or less. Now, you don't count the teacher, if there's a teacher in a world service group. You don't count that person, but everybody else gets counted. It's usually less than 12 or less. A very small group. Why do the groups get smaller when the job and task at hand gets bigger? Because the level of capability is so high, that's hard to find a half a dozen people at those levels, much less a dozen. And if you're going to wait to form the group until you have that many or more, you're never going to get them going. It's your hardness. It's tough. It's a toughie. It's really tough. It's better to evolve it through the lower groups, the higher groups, etc. At any rate, what's another thing that we can do to connect to our soul's prerogatives and help that to be developed right here where we are living souls functioning in one with our soul and the souls of others? Well, this gets a little tricky, and I'm going to try to put this in a light so that you don't do something that might be harmful. In almost every circumstance where people supposedly are trying to relate to God and become closer with God, there is an illusion in the physical world about it. Usually the illusion has to revolves around a specific religious viewpoint, but sometimes it also revolves around the illusion of what is or who is God, and then it sometimes also relates to people expecting to get something from God. You know what that's about. The way to deal with this is to start moving your interests and time and energy away from the places where people are stuck in those illusions. And that could be anything from soup kitchens to, you know, to helping people to maybe learn a certain kind of, let's say, biblical perspective. Now, am I anti-religion and anti-charity? No. I'm just saying, change your model of giving from a religious, charitable viewpoint, which is in the isms, and in the third part of the mind, of conception, to a higher conception of saying, I'm going to give as a soul now, and let others know that who are serving with you, co-serving with you in those places, if that's what you're doing with your life, of how you see you can serve better and come up with a plan, still doing actions, don't just get together and talk about it, where you can help others to become more souls themselves instead of just giving them something or just learning by rote some element of a Bible or some. Go beyond Sunday school and go to God school. That means that the activities you're going to replace need to have within them the framework of helping others to find God on this higher level. Not the God of a Bible, but the God of a soul. You've got to look at what you're doing from the perspective of the soul. Use this show as part of your understanding and other shows I've talked about. Read about souls in Life and Meaning or some other relevant book you find helpful. The very chapter I wrote is called About Souls, so that should help. And try to exercise within yourself a new kind of spiritual discipline. Not the spiritual discipline of showing up on time and giving X amount of dollars per month or whatever that might be, but the spiritual discipline of going against the establishment and established ways of supposedly giving to being a creator and eventually a co-creator with those you're going to help give to. As an example, it's okay to feed people if they're really hungry, but make sure that as soon as they get some food in them, they're out helping others to do something even more advanced than just feeding them. Doing something much more creative. So you see, what I'm saying is, you're not any longer just dealing with people on a personal level. Now, when you start dealing with other people by contrivance and by design, on a soul level, you're going to find people sometimes hating you, argumentatively saying you're defiling our religion, you're doing things against blank, blank, and this and that. Be willing to stand up to that and be willing to get hate mail. People just, you know, scribble something on your windows or your car or something. there's going to be a backlash. Why? Because the system, due to power and control issues from personal factors, has been contaminated in all elements of what is considered to be service, on the lower levels of service, to the person being controlled by a group that is controlled by personal interests. And so most religions fall into this category, and be prepared for that. And most service agencies fall into this category, whether they're religious or otherwise. So you need to now create something, and I'm being very general about this. I don't want to tell you specifics because I'm not the guy creating it for you. You've got to create it. But you've got to get into a totally different lane and be willing to accept some pretty hard knocks, because you're going to become a target for people who are into isms, particularly egotism. And people are going to threaten you, they're going to defile you, they're going to say that you're not good, you're doing this and that to harm, and so on. So, but be prepared for that. Accept it as part of the process. Don't get too much into defensiveness about it or fight back, well, I'll teach them a lesson. Just do your thing. Try to do your thing. I mean, unless someone really gets in your face and destroys your group or your agency or whatever, what you're trying to do in your work, you just keep going. I mean, if they do the other thing, then you got evil coming in. I mean, that's a whole other ballgame. Call me. I'll help you. But, okay, so what's another thing? What's the next step on the run, we can say, where you can really, really, you know, get outside of this issue and become your soul here? Well, you have to be doing these other things I'm talking about if you're going to get that far, okay? So now what is the next step? The next step is to start creating in a way, and this is probably going to involve some higher functioning groups that you'll co-create with. You may become a member of them, or you may just be a consultant. Maybe you'll give them money. Maybe you'll give them some type of energy and time that they need. But whatever this is, now you're going to create new, brand new ways of life being improved in an enlightenment way. Brings new ideas together with new forms of a creative expression to become what we'll call a true avant-garde creator, true in a spiritual sense. Can't do this alone. It's too far beyond what humans do. Unless you're a super genius and you've got great skills in certain things, it's not going to help. You really would have to have exceptional capabilities to do this alone. Well, most people today can't really function that way, so you need to be working together on this. And if you're willing to do this, you're going to need to give a lot more than you would in any of the other ways I just expressed. More money, more time, more energy. It's all going to get way cranked up there. And it becomes really the focus of almost every day, almost all the time and energy you have, almost all everything you have. But it is a creative, we'll call it a savant you're going to become, that is a soul savant. You're going to add things that are special eventually. First, for a few years, you may just be trying to give everything you already have. But then you're going to be creating so much more. Eventually, you'll give more that you created ever than whichever had before. That's the way it works. You're becoming a true living soul here. This sort of service means that it becomes virtually your whole life. You may or may not be in a world service group, but you will be certainly serving towards one and with one. The process is kind of scary because in this sort of thing, you're giving up the personal issues almost 100%, so you don't know where you're headed. Your lower self always wants to know and be encouraged by the personality enough that it knows where it's getting into and where it's headed. Now, to do this other kind of spiritual service, you know, by definition, you won't know where you're headed and what it's going to really mean, the cost or whatever. You just know by your true motive and inner being that you will give up everything to co-create with God, and that's what you're going to do here while you're physically alive. If you've got that going, and you really mean it, your personality will be absorbed into your soul. Now, this is a whole different thing now than the other ones I just mentioned, that becoming one with your soul in a personal way, and your lower self will become one with your higher self at the same time. They literally go in step together. You transform yourself from a human being into a real functioning soul here. Your capabilities jump to the level of the soul. So the soul doesn't have to worry anymore about trying to maximize whatever it's trying to do with you at your level of capability. It now is the soul here in its capabilities functioning. That's a whole big deal. You cannot reach this level until you're in the teens or higher in terms of soul consciousness. And for a lot of people, it's in the 20-30% or more range in soul consciousness. This is a huge, huge difference. The person's consciousness has to be really higher. Most people have about 2% soul consciousness while they're physically alive. You're going to be 10 to 20 times that. Wow. Eventually. You may start closer to the 10 times and eventually get closer to the 20 times. This is a big deal. I totally support people who are going to do this, although of the people listening to me, only a few will get to this level. And you will progress through everything I've talked to you about so far to get to here. Now, once you become the soul here, and I know it still sounds small, doesn't it? 20% of the time, it's only 1/5 of the day. But that's a lot. Once you reach that level, you don't need to have me telling you every day what to do. You may need some assistance on occasion from the people I spiritually co-serve with. But those people are available, and they will help. It doesn't have to be that you're helping this group that I'm around. Maybe you're helping some other group, but we're still here as teaching apparatus and helpful. But we will do what we can and be helpful. And your perspective will automatically change, because now your capabilities have opened to being that of the soul and your responsibilities are at that level. Once you take the responsibility of this new capability and you exercise it, your consciousness could easily expand past 30%, and you could, or not easily, but could expand past 30%, and it would be then a virtual miracle, because people at that kind of level start changing things hand over fist. I mean, it just really, almost every day is a new change to the world and to themselves. It's absolutely remarkable. Life, meaning goes sky high, difficulties go sky high, and you make a target on you that the dark side will be looking to try to stop you. That's okay. Don't worry about that, because you'll be with others who can withstand that, and together you'll be able to deal with it. But the issue here now is that so few people do this, and we need so many more who will. What are the numbers? I don't want to discourage it, but it's really low. Like, it's one out of many, many thousands of people will get to this level. But don't be discouraged by that. It doesn't matter what the numbers are. It matters who you are and whether you want to be this. If you want to be this, you can achieve it. Will you have stumbling blocks? Yeah. Will you have some fears? Yeah. Will you even sometimes have some doubts? Yeah. Can you do it? Yeah. You can do it. All right. So this is where the soul ultimately wants you to get to. and how long it will take. For the average person, probably greater than 10 years. The average person who is willing to try. For the exceptional person, probably half of that. And for the person who is kind of like, well, I'm going to try it, but I don't know, could take them the rest of their life, physically. Now, we're just talking about physical life here, because that's where it really counts. The soul, being a soul in the physical world, is 100 times more important than being a soul in the astral world. A lot of people become more soul-like in the astral world in comparison to their physical life, because it's so much easier. You know, the physical body is where most of the illusion is, and it's where you can always use it as an excuse, and where people live such a short life. We live an average 70, 80 years here. In the astral world, you live an average of maybe 400 or 500 years. You have a lot more time, a life to live, and it's so much easier because things happen virtually as you create with your imagination and thought. You can imagine all you want, but it's a very slow process because you've got to physically change things. Tough. The physics make it much more difficult. All right, what encouragement can you get from your soul? How do you know what I'm telling you is the truth? I mean, maybe I'm some kind of crazy guy just coming up with these really ridiculously difficult things for people to do, but they're all nonsense. How do you know it's true? Every time you do something that is in accord with the soul's prerogatives, the soul makes sure that you are made aware that it's a good thing. How does it do that? Well, through the things I started with earlier, it relieves you of conscience issues. You feel better that way. It opens up a channel that allows the solar angel to give you small amounts of communication beyond conscience. Oh, I didn't mention that one before, no. Because different threads or things or vortexes are connected to that being, and eventually those things start coming in. You actually have thoughts coming into your head, coming from where you don't know, but they prove themselves to be completely accurate, and it's from the solar angel. That's how it encourages you. What else does it do? It, through the solar angel, makes sure that you meet other people who are going to be helpful and not harmful to these goals. And they just magically bump into them. They call you. Maybe they listen to the show and they said, oh, I remember meeting that other guy or other gal 6 months ago, and they call you. Or they email you. How else does it do it? Well, it does it by small miracles. What's a small miracle? A small miracle is something you didn't expect you could achieve, and suddenly, by a set of circumstances that are almost impossible to believe they could happen together, do happen together. And what was an obstacle before becomes just another set of opportunities for you now. You take the opportunities, and lo and behold, it's amazing. Great outcomes. The soul can achieve that, provided that you're doing the things I've talked about tonight. So this is the proof. It's right there, and these things will happen. I promise you, they will happen. And I know this is the way the soul works. Can you have a discussion with your own soul, not the solar angel, with your own soul? There's a problem with that. And it has to do with something called the Rainbow Bridge. Some people call it the Antakarana. Whatever you want to call it, it's a connecting source. That the final part of the connecting source connects the soul to your own thoughts. But it's the final part, not the beginning parts. And that's the weakest link to your soul. So direct communication with your soul is more difficult than some communication with your solar angel in other places. It happens only after you have developed spiritual service, because that's what creates this third part, to a significant level. So after you have significantly served and co-served with others who are co-serving with God, you may have direct contact with the soul. Well, what the heck is that like? Well, I'm going to tell it to you, but you probably are it's going to be difficult to understand this. Direct contact with the soul is where you become fearless to the threats of existence, even the worst evil. The soul has no sense of fear, no sense of doubt or failure. You lose the negative qualities of what humans are often, and personalities are often controlled by. It's like chains have come off you. How many people has that happened to? Well, obviously not very many, because you got to do all these great spiritual services and things, but once you reach that point, you are a true free soul. You're not free from the mental world yet, but you're free here in the physical world. Now, how many people reach this state of freedom where they can communicate directly with their soul, meaning they and the soul are truly one? They know this because they communicate together as one. And they can recognize the individuality of each, but they work together as one. How many people does this happen to, this fearlessness, this strange sense of, we'll call it, both wonderment and a sense of authority and the ability to be and create virtually anything at will? Well, that's a fraction of those who are even spiritually serving. But you can get there. It may be the final knowingness and complete understanding that you and the soul are one. And there is such a thing as a soul altogether, but long before that you know that soul exists. But this is where you have the direct communication. It's you and the soul are one. How do you get there? Well, all the things I said. I know a lot of you say, well, you know, but you keep talking about, can I really do this? Yes, you can do it. As a matter of fact, except for the people who become evil, and even them eventually, maybe a million years, but will do it. At some lifetime, you will do it. I'm just trying to help you do it faster for the sake of all, everyone. Imagine, well, you say, well, describe this fearlessness, because I don't understand. Most people become afraid of their own creations, because they're creating in ways. The more creative you are, the more you're likely to make an error. An error causes a separation in time and space and causes suffering. So people don't want to suffer, so they're afraid of creation. But the soul isn't. Why not? Because to the soul, it understands something that the human is blocking with their personal interests. The soul says, hey, creation isn't a separation of time and space if you are humble, only if you're not humble, only if you're contaminated by the isms and you're egotistical. If you are totally humble, as the soul is, it never fears suffering. It doesn't. Because it doesn't separate time from space the way humans do. It actually brings time and space together for others first to reduce their suffering and accepts the suffering it has, because it always knows it reduces more suffering in others than it will have, and as far as it's concerned, we're all one. It recognizes its own individuality and the individuality of the person that is here being it. But that doesn't change its perspective. Suffering to it is suffering for all. Reduce greater the suffering of others, and whatever you suffer for your creation, in quote-unquote not being perfect, and no soul is perfect. Souls by nature are not perfect, remember that. They can be great beings, but not perfect. To be perfect, you've got to be fully one with God, and souls are separated by all kinds of things from God, but they are great beings. And so they don't mind this. And they don't have a fear of the suffering, because the meaning of their lives goes up even if the suffering does, and the meaning always is, it gets greater than any suffering they experience, and at the same time, those that they serve and serve with suffer less, and as far as they're concerned, that's a good trait. They got it. And they're not afraid. That's how you overcome fear. And I just said. Now, some of you are going to say, man, this guy is expecting me to be like godlike or something. Okay, yes, I am, because souls are godlike. They aren't God, they aren't perfect, but they are godlike. Honestly, they are. I know that's hard to understand, but once you get closer to it, it becomes a wonderment. It becomes a great joy and eventually bliss. Your life is something different. No problem, no issue ever is something more than an opportunity to create new and more with others, to co-create with God, to enlighten the world around us. That is what we're all aiming for. And hopefully tonight's show has given you some perspective on that. And guess what? You got an extra 35 minutes or so of a show to do that, thanks again to this radio station. And also recognize that these things take some time, because you're not going to get to the end of this process in 5 minutes or maybe even 5 years. But you will get there. Can you do it in this life? Yes. Well, what if you're 85 years old? You will live longer and be healthier as you exercise these parts of being a soul here and now. You will live as long as your soul chooses you to live. And once you are the soul, you will live as long as you choose to serve at the higher and higher levels that I have discussed this evening. It is your choice, once you're your soul, for your prerogative of life and death. So the fear of death, which is the ultimate of all fears, by the way, goes away because you're choosing when you're going to die. It is a choice. It's a choice. A choice for those who have become their soul. And that's the reason, ultimately, why all fear goes away. Amazing, huh? You know. Now, for some of you, some of this is going to be a little difficult to understand because you didn't listen to prior shows I had about death and my, you know, fears. And some of this may require a bit more listening on some other shows because I don't want to take any more time tonight about those because I wanted to stay on this subject. But there is further explanation available if you want to go back and listen to some of the other shows I've had on the subjects. So as you can see how it all fits together. And it all makes perfect sense if you understand enough of what I've explained. That gives you the creative ability from the soul's prerogatives to 100% at some point create what and how and what kind of life you're going to have while you're physically alive. You truly are the soul here, and you can make it that way through the suggestions that I've given you tonight. Well, yeah, we're running out of time. I'm going to break it off in just a few seconds here. I really hope that tonight's show has helped you, and it has meant something, as it has to me, to be of some value in the soul's prerogatives. And remember, you can be that soul right now, right here, while you're physically alive. Well, until next week, this has been Niles McFlower for Why Life